Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, Boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the Boneheads, Ryan Howard, and tonight's going to be interesting. We've got a couple topics to discuss with a returning guest, one of my compatriots taking advantage of the basic expert's infinite patience in his gilded server. That is the one and only Alchemic Raker. We've got a couple things to discuss tonight. Most importantly, though, we're going to be talking about preparation and items in the D&D rule books that a lot of people overlook or don't understand. You know, we're going to be talking about prep time and preparation and how important that is in gaming. So I'm looking forward to that. We'll probably touch on a couple other topics, too. Just want to remind everyone before we bring Raker on here again. I want to remind everyone to like, share, and subscribe. This is the best way to get the word out about what we're doing over here on Rollin' Bones. And of course, you can find me in all of the various social media platforms that I find myself on X and Instagram. I am at Howard_RyanGregg. YouTube is Rollin' Bones, and Twitch is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. And of course, Substack is RollinBones.substack.com. I will have a Substack article up this week about the Batman Arkham series and how it basically how it has influenced my take on dungeon design and, you know, the way that I have approached designing adventures in, you know, Nighthaven specifically, but just kind of in general. How that particular series has influenced me as far as, you know, making games. And also want to remind everyone, we are in the final 39 hours. We are less than a work week away from the end of Guts and Glory Volume 1's Kickstarter. We are sitting at $5,552 right now. We are in the realm where there will be 2 one-page dungeons included in the world of Nighthaven, alongside the one-page dungeons that Wonky is doing, alongside all the stuff you were already getting from Guts and Glory Volume 1. We are a mere $500 away from being able to turn all of those limited edition soft covers into hardcovers. That is what I want to see by the end of this campaign. So I hope you guys will help us get there. Even if it's not tonight, you know, if it's tomorrow, if it's at the 11th hour, I would be over the moon excited to see that. But this is it. This is the last push. This is the last stand for you guys to really help us kind of push this first campaign over the top and really deliver something special, something awesome. I mean, we're going to do that anyway, but, you know, this is just to make something awesome even more awesome. And speaking of things that are awesome, let's go ahead and bring on tonight's guest. He, like I said, is one of my compatriots over in Basic Experts Gilded server. He is a great follow over on X or Twitter, whatever you prefer to call it. He's got a lot of great gaming takes, and he is here to share some wisdom with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to Rollin' Bones, Mr. Alchemic Raker.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Ryan.
Oh, no problem, man.
And welcome back. It's been awesome, you know, getting to join into this community and the server and even like the discussions on Twitter. There's so many great people once you find them. I've learned so much in the last probably year and a half, 2 years alone, you know, getting back into these games.
There's
a lot of bad takes too.
There are. There's this weird thing. this weird thing that keeps happening where, here, let me rephrase that. Sorry, I've had my whiskey for the evening. I've put a lot of shade on Twitter. I've talked a lot bad about just the state of the discourse over there. Because like you said, there's a lot of bad takes over there. There's constant bad takes. But there's also been a lot of really interesting things to read over there. There's lots of people who constantly have just interesting takes from reading rule books, whether it's the bros or Crossface or John McGowan, someone that I discovered on Twitter, you know, just all kinds of different great guys and even some great girls out there making some great posts about their experiences running and reading these rules. So as down as I have been on kind of the discourse on Twitter, there's still some good stuff to be found there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Some of the best stuff I've found lately has been, in the last year has been from Twitter. Mm-hmm.
Now, unfortunately, we're going to kick things off here by looking at some of the not so great takes to be found on Twitter. One of my favorite people that I've discovered on Twitter is one Harmony Ginger. She's a delightful human being. You've heard her on the show before, but she had this post, on Monday, it looks like. I had a friend tell me this weekend that he tried D&D, but he didn't think it was for him because he wasn't a good actor. I don't know if anyone else needs to hear this, but acting is not a requirement to play RPGs. It's a game, not a performance. First of all, based.
Yeah.
But, when Harmony was on the show, she and I had a conversation about this, and she comes at gaming from a very interesting viewpoint, and that's, she got started playing games like Diplomacy. And so mm-hmm. when she approaches D&D, it's from that perspective. This, like, the idea that you have to speak in character or use a voice or that's kind of a secondary or even tertiary thing in role playing. And I say that as someone who likes to speak in character and likes to speak with a character voice, and who is or was at one point a professional actor. Mm. That's not what the game's about. The game's a game.
No, absolutely. I agree with her completely on this, and I agree with a lot of her takes. I think she's it sounds like she's an awesome DM. She's one of the top follows on Twitter right now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the clowns got a hold of it, or specifically the clown, that being one Mr. J. Scott Garibay, everyone's favorite. DoorDash driver delivered this lukewarm coal to everyone's doorstep, saying, "This opinion is antiquated and wrong. Without question, Matthew Mercer has changed D&D forever." Now, it's been a while since I was in school. Raker, correct me if I'm wrong here. Harmony did not mention blanket enthusiast Matt Mercer in her tweet, did she?
Not at all.
That's what I thought.
So. I've got glasses on to help me see, and I didn't see anything about that in there.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So not recognizing that is a path to failure in any D&D game today. He is the bar. We don't have to match the bar in every session, but we can't simply pretend it's not there. Oh my God.
I mean, it hurts, but that's where a lot of, that's what a lot of people are being mentored by, is that idea. They're coming into it with that as players and as DMs, apparently, mm-hmm. I think gatekeeping is good. Because there are ideas like this out there that you have to address, right? And an argument could be made for, people we'll have preferred ways to play to have fun. Mm-hmm. But what he's saying is not how you play D&D, right? This is just not.
This Cole here, first of all, to address some of the people in chat, Rex Teal calls out a very good video that Black Lodge Games made covering this particular topic. I don't understand how you come to this conclusion. I understand that Critical Role is unbelievably popular. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to deny the popularity of Critical Role. What I am here to deny is that Critical Role is an accurate representation of how the game is played. Critical Role is first and foremost an entertainment product.
It is a show, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, Harmony, we are talking about you.
It is
only good things, though. So, I don't understand. I don't understand how this take comes to someone's mind. And I've talked a lot about there being bars set for how, you know, D&D is best played. For me, mm-hmm. that is getting as close as you possibly can to the rules and playing mm-hmm. in kind of perfect accord with the rules that you have set for yourself and playing well within that framework, which we'll get to here in just a little bit. That to me is the bar of D&D. It always has been, and it always will be.
Totally agree.
Recreating the game style of a voice actor. That's not very high on my priority list. If Matt Mercer is to be, like, I guess a Christ figure in J. Scott Garibay's formulation of D&D here, WWMCD, or sorry, WWMMD, what would Matt Mercer do? That's not even a priority at all. Matt Mercer and I are completely different people. We're going to approach the game and run it in completely different ways. Even if Matt Mercer were playing rules as written and were actually like presenting D&D as it's intended to be played by everyone on Critical Role, your goal is not to one-to-one recreate Matt Mercer's game.
No. And I know some people say, you know, Matt Mercer's when stuff started going wrong, and I don't agree with that either. I think that people have been inclined to not play D&D since the very beginning. And you hear people about that all the time. It's like, oh, I've played this way for 40 years. Okay, but you're not using the rules, and the rules, you know, the rules express the game different than what you're saying that you're playing.
Yeah.
And so you're just wrong about that. And what they're doing instead is they're playing a fantasy of what they want the game to be. Mm-hmm. And the very common one of that is the DM that should be a writer, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, I've got a great idea, and here's how I'm going to let a lot of people enjoy it. You know, I'm going to be very charitable as I try to describe this person, but that is what they've made D&D into, is a way to let some story they have come to life. And that is not what D&D is about. And that goes back to the very beginning. And now with Matt Mercer, there's like another incarnation of thinking about things wrong, where now they want the fantasy of it being as fun as the show seems to be. For those people that enjoy the show. And I'm sure that people who enjoy the show find it quite fun. I haven't watched very much of it, but I don't really think it's for me. and they want to play that fantasy of D&D. Mm-hmm. But again, that's a fantasy of D&D. That's not the game that is D&D. And that's just what it is you can try to call other things D&D, but they're not. And that, I guess it doesn't baffle me that people are wrong about it, but it is a real shame. Mm-hmm. You know?
And that, like, I don't have anything personally against Matt Mercer or any of the cast of Critical Role. I know people who have interacted with him on a personal basis, and they say that he's a very nice, very personable individual. He's obviously very successful. The problem that I have is this deification of Matt Mercer, the beatification of Matt Mercer as essentially the god of D&D. That's what I have a problem with. That, and for one, it's not correct. It's not the way that D&D is meant to be played. I don't know how many different ways to say this, but I think Matt Mercer, unless he's changed, unless it's all actually gone to his head, I don't think Matt Mercer would tell you that he is some kind of gold standard that you are supposed to attain. I think he's just doing the thing that makes him successful. And I think he's just doing a thing that he likes to do. He certainly has had his cringe moments. He does things that I don't like. But I don't think his goal here is to, like, have everyone bow down to the altar of Critical Role and, you know, sacrifice their, you know, the first of their fruits to Mercer so that he may continue creating campaigns and continue running them for everyone. Like, it's cringe celebrity worship nonsense. And I really wish it would go away. I really hate it. It's completely ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, that's so often the case, though, is you have these successful people, and there's so many of these successful people, and they give bad advice. They're people too, and they can give bad advice. They happen to be more successful, and there's reasons that they're more successful, and it might not be something that they can explain, and they can attribute it to certain things, and they can say, oh, well, Mercer thinks the game should be played this way. That's fine. He could still be wrong about that. And he can still be fun to watch. Like, those aren't mutually exclusive ideas. You know, you see this with holiday celebrities giving their takes on things and stuff like that, too. You know, a lot of people can be very successful and very wrong.
Yeah, Harmony makes a good point here in chat. A lot more DMs have probably learned from watching CR than have read the DMG. And that's kind of the problem. I'd say that's 100% of the problem, because, again, CR is not an accurate representation of how, like, the game works at the table. And the other thing you see, keeping that sentence in mind, more DMs have probably learned from watching CR than have read the DMG. Then you factor in that phenomenon of a year or so ago of DM burnout being this gigantic thing that was, you know, taking over the discourse, and you know, more and more people are just intimidated to get behind the screen. They, you know, they're afraid to try it because they think they've got to be a fantasy author, or they think they have to be an actor. And all of this conception of role playing as those things comes directly from Critical Role and all of its imitators. And so that's kind of the crux of the problem that we're dealing with in modern gaming, is instead of learning from the source, instead of learning from the book that they purport to be running out of, they're learning from these people who are quite literally working off of the script. They have writers. Our friend Pancho Goblin knew someone who wrote for them. It's not 100% authentic and off the cuff gaming the way that, like, your table is. They've got script writers.
Yeah. And Critical Role has certainly given a lot of has really validated that view and understanding of the game, that it's more of an acting thing or a storytelling thing. And again, that's not something that started with Critical Role. I think that a lot of ground was made very ready for Critical Role to be like, ha, see, you know, we told you. Because if you read the fifth edition DMG, it tells you to like plan story arcs and plan a bad guy for your campaign. It tells you to plan these things as a DM. And then it'll also go around and say, but make sure that your players are free to do stuff and make sure that they, you know, are free to take actions and stuff. And it's trying to force the DM to like play both sides of that equation. Yeah. And that explanation, the DMG, does not date back to original, like first edition and OD&D. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether or not that it started appearing in the second edition DMG. I haven't read the second edition DMG. But certainly with WotC D&D, certainly with third edition, it was giving advice to start planning overarching stories and like have those kinds of ideas in mind. Mm-hmm. And that already started to muddy the waters for the DM's mind.
Yeah.
And for those people that want to come and play D&D as something that it's not what it says in the book, as a non-game, they will read a book and look for validation of their point of view. And they can latch on to just that couple of sentences in the third edition DMG, or like the entire first several chapters of the fifth edition DMG, and be like, well, look, these are the only part that matters. We can ignore all the rest of the rules because this says I can tell a story. And, you know,
yeah.
Okay, but you don't have a game anymore once you do that, you know? So WotC at least has, you know, made this bed. Maybe TSR started it, you know, sort of, I'm sure.
I would argue that TSR actually did start it. And this is where I'm going to lose people. With apologies to folks like Yodano, and some of you probably already know where I'm going with this. The problem started with Dragonlance. I'm sorry to all of you Dragonlance fans out there. Dragonlance is the reason why we have to deal with this shit. Malachi's right. It's Dragonlance. You've got these successful novels, and yeah, they're fun fantasy stories. But then they're transformed into transformed into adventures. And so you have these adventures that are running you through the plot of a novel, and there's no room for anything but being on the railroad. You know, it's a dark ride at that point. It's not even a roller coaster. It's like that Men in Black ride at Universal Studios where you're, you know, taken through the room and you shoot the aliens. That's Dragonlance.
Yeah.
And like, again, apologies to those of you who like Dragonlance, but that's just God's honest truth. And everything that has replicated Dragonlance, and you know, everyone who's taken inspiration from Dragonlance, that's the way that they're approaching D&D now, because that's, you know, they have this nostalgia, which I think is mostly for the novels. I think a lot of the people who love Dragonlance probably haven't played very many of the adventures. They're remembering the novels more than the actual adventure modules. And so, like, that's the expectation for how modules are written and how games are run. And so that, like, that's why we're here. So it does start before WotC.
Yeah.
I would argue, yeah, I'd agree with your argument there that it starts kind of at third edition is where it gets really bad. I mean, like I've said before that D&D died in 2000, but that's just the, like, unfortunately, that's the way that people have been taught to run. And that's why, you know, Jeffro Johnson gets so much mileage out of saying, don't read anything written after 1980.
I mean, if we want to go back to the TSR era, what I found wrong with the TSR era is I would go back to way before Dragonlance. I would say that things started going wrong with everything published after the original OD&D books.
Okay.
And I say that because the problem I said earlier, where people are reading the rules looking for validation for what they believe the game is, mm-hmm. and then they'll see something like Rule Zero that says, you know, the rules are in service of having fun, so ignore them if you want to. And there'll be some variation of sentence that people will read, and they'll say, okay, this is my permission to make this the fantasy game I want it to be. Mm-hmm. And I know why it was in OD&D, because it was a wargaming supplement. And yep. that made sense to a wargamer. It did not make sense to people just picking up a D&D in isolation. Mm-hmm. And Rule Zero has continued to do that. I think that Rule Zero has been one of the worst things for D&D.
Yeah.
And that Rule Zero hasn't been properly clarified. And I think even one first edition fails on that front. Even though it tried very hard to be like, look, D&D is a game with rules. Like, one first edition tries to say that. It tries to say that a lot. And then it still leaves like Rule Zero type clauses around. And it's weak language that continues to enable the non-game to exist. And I don't think that it's served by that. Mm-hmm. So I would go all the way back to first edition for including any of that wishy-washy language at all.
I see what you're saying. I don't necessarily hold that against like AD&D 1E or Gary or Zeb or whoever it mm-hmm. was that decided to put that wording in there. I do like the phrase, the rules exist, like basically the rules exist to create fun. That's, I agree with that. And that's why I believe in adhering to the rules as strongly as I do. It's the thesis of that Bluey episode that we've all been talking about recently,
yeah.
where when you change the rules willy nilly, you're cutting the legs out from under your fun. And so the rules exist to create fun because they create restrictions on what you can or cannot do at certain periods of time. However, because people have poor reading comprehension skills, mm-hmm. over time that has evolved into, yes, you bought this book of rules, but you don't actually need it. Just do whatever you want. And I don't think that's the... And like Dundermoose says, first edition is the best. Gary assumed he was talking to equals. So, that's... Gary assumed that people would know what he was talking about. And there's a lot of assumptions on the part, there's assumptions of intelligence on the part of the mm-hmm. authors of early D&D, which we'll get into here in just a second when we start talking about tents. Yeah. But that, I feel like, is where Rule Zero comes from. And it's the lack of studiousness, the lack of intelligence, the lack of reading comprehension skills that have mutated this Rule Zero into the monster that it's become today.
I agree completely there. I understand why first edition even included Rule Zero. I'm just noting that it continued to enable the Rule Zero stands to continue yeah. outside D&D. And that's always been the flaw with it since the beginning. I don't really want to pick apart the language of it. It's just that's created one of the biggest geists of D&D for this entire time.
It definitely did.
And that certainly precedes Dragonlance, and mm-hmm. Dragonlance enabled them back then the same way that Critical Role is doing now.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right, you want to talk about tents?
Oh yeah.
All right, let's talk about tents. This is what you guys are here for. And thank you to Harmony and others who have recognized the pun that I made in the stream title here. I'm very proud of that one. So this is kind of where this all started. Again, this is a week old at this point. Our good friend our good friend Crossface, made this post saying equipment packs being the default for campaign play in 5th edition and how typical character creation ignores equipment lists as a whole is a disservice to the game and players both. Quote, do you have a tent? End quote. And then in response to that question, quote, I don't know, what's in an explorer's pack? End quote. And your response to this, kind of echoing the sentiment of Crossface here, when players don't prepare, they don't even know what tools they have at their disposal. If you hand wave it, players now have a presumption of not having to prepare. Way to cheat them out of one of their biggest expressions of agency. Knocked it out of the park. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yes. Thank you. Going back to Crossface's tweet there, the equipment packs being the default for campaigns, I've been back and forth on equipment packs being a thing, and this is probably the strongest argument I've heard against using equipment packs, mm-hmm. Because they didn't exist in earlier D&D, and that got me thinking about why. And the situation you described here is a real situation that, you know, happens even more now that there's equipment packs. And not just equipment packs, but the default equipment, starting equipment for classes in general, right? Yep. Is here, write a couple things down, and that's what you have. And that's your preparation for the game. Like, that's what you've done to prepare for adventure. And they'll write down equipment packs, and that obscures even more about what they actually have. I agree completely. So they've just written something down on the character sheet, and now they no longer know what they have. Mm-hmm. If they had gone shopping the way that, you know, 3.5 edition was the first edition I played, and we picked out every single thing, every single item from the equipment and stuff, mm-hmm. and we knew exactly what was on our character sheet. We knew exactly what was in our inventory at all times, and I would have known if I had a tent. Right? I bought a tent. I lost it. So I don't know where my tent is anymore. That's true story in real life. We had a tent in 3rd edition because I know I bought one and I wasn't the only person who did. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it being obscured has just made things worse. And that even came up in the 5th edition campaign I'm playing right now, which is like very by the rules, you know, we're not skipping over stuff like that. And the players bought equipment packs, and because some of them use the pre-made, you know, the default stuff, and they're like, well, what's in the equipment pack? And so they know what's in their equipment pack, and they know that they don't have a tent, and they have to work with that, and you know, they're being meticulous about it. But a player who's sitting down, who's never played before, doesn't know necessarily that they have to do that. But in earlier editions, it's like, well, you picked your class and you rolled your stats. What's left to do? Not picking out skills or anything like that, you know? Not picking out subclasses. All you have is preparing for adventure. Mm-hmm. And shopping is what differentiates you from other characters right off the bat. And everyone's going to prepare differently.
Yeah. And I don't necessarily have a problem with equipment packs. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is equipment packs exist to simplify the process. So rather than having players go through and buy individual equipment, an equipment pack, yeah, and you know this already, I know, mm-hmm. The equipment pack exists so that you can just say, all right, you know, this has this, 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 and this. So I will buy this pack and, you know, that'll be the equipment that I have. That that's a choice though. Yeah. You have the choice to piecemeal buy your equipment. You know, I think I'll need this. I don't think I'll need this. So I'm going to go ahead and buy this individually, or I'm going to buy this pack. I know there's stuff in here I might not need, but you never know. There's couple things that I do need, so let me just get this pack. However, even with equipment packs, even with starting equipment, even with templates like in Adventurer Conqueror King system or the class packs and Castles and Crusades, it's still incumbent upon players to understand what they have in those packs.
Yep.
And a lot of people in this discourse were mentioning things like, you know, hey, what does a tent even do in 5e? You know, why does it matter? You know, there's not a usage listed next to a tent for what it does or something like that. There's not a usage listed in almost any rule book for what most stuff does. Crossface and I were actually going over this privately together, and he showed me the equipment list in OD&D and said, do you see any descriptions of what these things do in here? I said, no. And you know, the reason why is you have all these different items, and instead of Gary specifically telling you, hey, this is what this does, it's up to you, the player, to decide mm-hmm. what to do with that equipment. My favorite example of this is the 10-foot pole. No one was ever told explicitly, outright, in a D&D book that you use a 10-foot pole to feel the ceilings and the walls and the floor in front of you for traps. That's folk knowledge. That mm-hmm. is something that has been like passed down from generation of gamers to generation of gamers. It's folklore for gaming at this point. People name like podcasts and stuff after it. A 10-foot pole was just an item with a cost in, I believe, silver pieces in 0E. And someone very early on figured out, hey, if I buy this pole, if I spend my money to just buy this stick that does nothing, I can use it to poke the walls and poke the floor and, you know, check for those pit traps and stuff like that. And that's just it. Like, other players saw that and were like, that's brilliant. So next time they played, they were like, hey, I'm going to carry around this 10-foot pole. And suddenly it just became the default usage for it. It's the same with every piece of equipment, and every piece of equipment's got multiple uses, even the tent. Mm-hmm. Like people are going over, like Malachi here, tent keeps you dry. Yeah. It keeps you dry and it keeps the wind out. Also, if you run into a situation where you need strips of canvas, like, you know, you need makeshift bandages or something, you're going to use up your tent doing this, but you can cut off strips of canvas from your tent. You can use the tent to make people think you're camping in one place to set up an ambush. There's all kinds of different uses for all of these different items. But
Go on.
Just when you completely take away the process of preparation and the process of equipping your character intentionally and just say, you know, you have whatever you need, just hand wave it completely or abstract it away in some way that makes the process of buying equipment before the adventure trivial. You're taking away this ability for people to use weird items for, like, to come up with weird creative usage, to have that MacGyver moment where mm-hmm. they pull out their Swiss Army knife and the synthesizer music starts playing and they start building some kind of weird Rube Goldberg machine that's somehow going to help them, like, take out 15 orcs mm-hmm. or something. You are robbing your players of the chance to do something like that when you abstract away this idea of, did you bring a tent?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that is obviously not just for tents, but I see the argument for tent being like, oh, you're gonna punish your players for going out into the wilderness without a tent now, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Not a single one of the equipment packs includes a tent in mm-hmm. 5th edition. You know, you got to buy a tent separately, and you got to opt into it. And you've had to do that since the 0 edition of D&D you've had to be like, oh, I want to buy a temp, and then you have to do that, you know? And if you just have the most obnoxious DM, first edition DM, following Gary's advice for how to run NPCs, you might be starting every session with not enough gold to buy a tent. So right. If you don't buy a tent with your starting gold, you might never get one unless you steal it, you know, or make one of your own. Like, people are going to play the game in different ways. And having just that list of items, like, here's like some core stuff that adventurers are going to work with, it is part of D&D back to the, you know, the original version. And like, you can tell who has experience with dungeon delving, because they're in there getting the iron spikes too.
Yeah.
You know, those are amazing things. And like,
Crafty mentions a use here.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, every new player is like, oh, let's make sure we have some rope, right?
Yeah.
But the smart ones have the iron spikes, you know, and they know what the 10-foot pole's for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're being resourceful. So,
yeah.
Like, most DMs, when they think about, like, how am I going to get ready for the next session? You know, when the DM is preparing to run the game, and they're thinking about, well, what content do I need to get ready for? I would say most fifth edition DMs have combat in mind. You know, you want to have some combat scenario ready or potential for it. And you want some other challenges. You know, you want social encounters or environmental encounters, and you want to give the players like something to think about there. But they don't consider, like, one of the core pillars of the game is the player preparation part of the game. And that's the player's freedom of where and how they want to engage with the game, and yeah, the freedom of how to play the game. And just having that list of items is, like, at the root of all of that is, what am I going to buy? How am I going to play this game? You know, am I going to be someone who buys a tent and just goes into the wilderness for a long time? Am I going to be someone who always stays around towns and never has to do that? Am I going to leech off of someone else's tent, or just deal with it? Deal with not having a tent. Maybe they want to do that. You know, you don't know. Maybe they want a covered wagon instead, and they want to live out of that. You know, D&D has always asked this of the players, and I don't think that it's fair to rob them of that. Or to say, well, you know, here, I'm just going to give you a tent because you happen to be out in the wilderness and you forgot to buy it, but I know you meant to. You know, adventurers wouldn't have forgotten that. Well, clearly they did. Clearly they did forget. You know,
and we've seen, like, yeah, the reactions to this. There are some that say, like, your character should just have brought what they need because they're experienced adventurers. Well, we're going to set that aside for now because that's its own stupidity. But, you know, there were a couple responses saying, okay, well, you know, yes, resources need to have a cost, and it's important to have the right resources. Why not have a system so that when your players are in a situation where they need something, they can mark off the gold pieces on their character sheet and then just have it as if they had prepared for it the whole time? This is also a mindset that robs players of the opportunity created by not having something you need. As G.K. Chesterton once said, adventure is inconvenience rightly considered. So let's say, in this hypothetical situation, you don't have a tent. There's a storm coming. You need shelter. You need something over top of your head, or you're going to have a bad night and you're not going to be able to, you know, rest up and gain all the benefits of a rest, whatever they may be in the particular system you're using, because you're not going to be able to sleep through the night with all the like pouring rain that's going to come down on top of you. So now you have a timer element at play with the storm coming in, and you have a search for shelter. That shelter is going to take you maybe to a very heavily wooded area. More than likely, it's going to take you to a cave. What is the entrance to a cave to a GM? The opportunity for a dungeon that you didn't plan out. So, you know, inevitably, there's going to be something in the cave, whether it's a monster that has already claimed this as its own shelter, you know, the corpse of an adventurer that had some kind of treasure map, or, you know, it's the mouth to a dungeon. Maybe it's the mouth to the dungeon the players were looking for, but they got lost. There's all kinds of opportunity that presents itself when players have to scramble for resources. And the other thing that this does, especially in fifth edition, people complain about how useless the ranger is. When you're actually tracking food and water and shelter and making that matter, even the ranger, as he's presented in the fifth edition PHB, becomes a very valuable resource. So when you start abstracting away resource management, or making it so that you can just mark off gold pieces on your character sheet and have what you need, you're taking roles that are essential to the game away from people. You're taking opportunities away from players to ad lib when they don't have the resources that would help them. You know, your players don't have rope. What are they going to use instead of rope? How are they going to overcome this situation where it seems obvious that rope would be the answer? How are they going to find shelter when they don't have tents? How are they going to do this, that, or the other without necessary resource? This is the like crux of actual role play and adventure. Like this is the high that we're all chasing. This is role playing at its highest, in its highest form. As Ginger Frazier would say, this is living truthfully in your given imaginary circumstances, to put it in acting terms. Why would you take that away from your players? Why would you take that chance to have something cool happen because someone forgot the tent? Like, why would you do that?
I have an answer, but it's not a nice answer. and it's because it's inconvenient to the DM.
Yeah.
But the DM is like, well, I had stuff planned, you know, and again, being generous to the DM, because the DM has pressures, especially the pressures that conventional play puts on DMs, is that they have to run something for the night. And what they've prepared is not a cave for the adventurers to go hide in, you know. I need them to get to their destination or whatever it is. And so we're just not going to worry about that. You know, they're just going to hand wave it entirely. We're not going to remedy this to give you a tent. It's whatever, you get there, you know. They're going to skip it entirely, which is a real shame, exactly like you said. Why would you stop that? And it's things like that. It's that pressure the DM has to hand wave the inconveniences to them, that reduces emergent role playing, which is what you're describing. You know, these emergent exciting situations, emergent adventures, comes because someone forgot to buy a freaking tent.
Yeah,
like it's that simple, and now you have a really cool adventure that you can go on, right? But it's not what was prepared for, and the DM is not as comfortable as they want to be with improvising on the spot, and so they're going to solve the problem in another way. And that's going to be to just hand wave it. It's a simple little thing, and now the game can go on as intended. But that influences more than just that one decision they made. You know, they have that pressure in a lot of ways to just move things along, and that robs the players repeatedly. You know, every single little thing like that will be inconvenient to someone who has to plan stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not inconvenient if you are leaning into the emergent aspect of D&D. And there's emergent stuff all over the place. You know, when you don't use, critical hit tables and, you know, well, I don't want to like hack off my player's hand or, you know, their character's hand. That would be like really inconvenient. They'll be upset at me, whatever. Okay, but now that player gets to go back and commission an iron hand,
yeah.
You know, or like a freaking crossbow, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's cool. And you just robbed the players of that because for no reason, really, because mm-hmm. you didn't think it through. But that would be freaking awesome.
If your player's a huge Berserk fan, you just let them down big time.
Big time, exactly. Or if they want their hand back, then you go see a cleric and you plop down some gold because you're an adventurer. You've got gold because you're giving gold to your players, right? Like you better be letting them collect gold. Gold is like one of the other. Gold ties in to that pillar of play with the player preparation. Is such a foundational pillar of play. They have gold so they can spend it on resources, which is the starting items, like the item lists and equipment lists, but also on mercenaries, you know, and hirelings, or on spells whenever they need the aid of spells. You know, one of the party members just died. We got to go resurrect. Mm-hmm. And all of that is part of the game for the players.
Yep.
And whenever you hand wave away something about when the players didn't prepare something and you hand wave or you're like, okay, well, you're in the wilderness. You would have bought a tent. So mark off the gold for the tent. That's fudging. That's fudging the rules because they didn't buy a tent.
Yep.
And now they're in the wilderness without a tent. So like, if you change that, unless there's, you know, a traitor in the wilderness who has a tent for them, which is highly suspect, you know, they're not going to have a tent. And I don't think that it's right to do it that way because you're undermining that part of the game. The players who prepare are rewarded for it. And it's extremely satisfying, you know, especially when they get into the MacGyver moments.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then whenever they are in that phase of the game where it's like, okay, you're in town, you know, what do you want to do while you're in town? And some of the players are going to be like, all right, well, I have like this list of things that I want to make sure that we're prepared for. We're going to throw this all in the wagon. I'm going to get an extra horse too, in case we lose one, right? That player is doing a lot of work and they're going to be really satisfied whenever it turns out they needed that extra horse or whatever extra thing they threw in the wagon. And for the players who didn't, they're going to deal with it, and it's fine because the game still works. The game doesn't stop working because they forgot to buy a tent.
Right. Yeah. And Crafty Matt here in chat, Jeff Talanian told the story about adventuring party buying a handheld bellows while on a hunt for vampire. He actually told the story. For those of you who don't remember, the vampire turns into mist and the party sucks it up into the bellows. He told that story on the show, on here, when I asked him what his fondest RPG memory was. This was the story that he told of sucking up a vampire with handheld bellows. These are the kinds of crazy things you can do when you pay attention to equipment and, you know, buy all sorts of random junk. Like, I talk about this movie a lot, especially in terms of D&D. Would John McClane have taped the Beretta to his back with one shot in it at the end of Die Hard if his GM had said, no, you're a cop, you definitely would have conserved enough ammunition to make sure that you don't have to, you know, just have one bullet and do some kind of tricky thing just to, you know, get your way. No. That's what makes the movie, is the fact that by the end of it, his feet are cut up with jagged shards of glass and he has a Beretta with one bullet left in it taped to his back. Like, that's what makes Die Hard. Okay. Crafty said two bullets. Yeah. He's got two bullets left. He has two rounds left, but like, that's what makes Die Hard Die Hard. That's what makes the scene in Temple of Doom where Indiana Jones is up against two swordsmen and he goes for his revolver and doesn't have it and has to use his whip. That's what makes that scene interesting. Yeah. There's all kinds of moments in cinema and stories where the heroes find themselves with their backs to the wall, not having the necessary equipment that they need to do something. Every episode of the A-Team ended with, you know, that montage of the theme song and them just pulling random parts off of stuff and building some kind of weird machine to help them overcome the long odds they were facing. Every episode of MacGyver had multiple moments like this. This is like the core of storytelling. How is your group of heroes going to overcome the long odds? And the answer is by being resourceful. And so you have to allow your players the agency to be resourceful.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly right. God, I lost my train of thought there. So the limited resources, you know, gold's the limited resources, but all the stuff that they buy and their preparations in general are all resources that they have. And those resources get tested.
Yeah.
And whenever those resources hit their limits, that's when you get all sorts of awesome emergent role-playing, emergent storytelling, right? People want their games to be as great as the stories that they read, right? That's what a lot of people are driven by, that idea. So like, I want this to be as awesome as Dragonlance, right? Then let players hit those limits. Because it creates those situations. And this was one of the things that shocked me so much whenever I went back and read first edition and zero edition, is just how narratively focused it was. Is, you know, I was told that these were crunchy war game things, but they're amazingly narrative focused. Is they have these rules that define the world that an adventurer exists in.
Yeah.
And the world is one that creates these narratives, right? It gives you the adventurer equipment. So that's what you're stuck with, and that's what you're going to be using. Using that's going to make you feel like an adventurer. And it throws you into encounters that are all these like mythical tropes. You know, you're going to run into these crazy things in the desert. And whenever you run out of resource and you're fighting dinosaurs in the freaking desert or swamp, like that's going to be something cool. Something cool is going to happen there.
Yeah.
And you don't have to plan it. You know, the game is already doing that. And the 1 minute combat rounds is another thing where that's obviously not one attack. And so you get to role play what that attack is, you know, what's going on there. That's very narratively focused, which, you know, I was under the wrong impression for a long time about that. I was like, okay, you know, fifth edition is probably like the most narratively focused one. I was very wrong about that. Mm-hmm. You know, it tells the DM to make story, but its mechanics don't lend itself to that emergent narrative. And the advice it gives does not lend itself to that emergent narrative experience the way that the earlier editions do.
Yep. Macho Mandolf makes a point here about resource management. You know, if the players discussed what tent to buy all week during downtime, he'd be lenient if they forgot to actually buy. Yeah, like that's definitely a situation where you can be like, okay, yes, I know you guys meant to buy a tent. You were so busy arguing over the duck of the canvas that you were going to get or however granular you were getting with your tent argument that you forgot to actually buy one. That's fine.
Yeah.
But you're onto something there with, you know, and a lot of grogs will kind of like shudder at saying this, but a lot of grogs play the game wrong. So, you know, there's that. These rules are designed to create, you know, these moments like you see in the Conan stories or like you see in Lord of the Rings. They're just designed to create them emergently. They're designed to allow the party to be in situations where they can be heroic. It's not about creating some kind of storyline or epic, quest line that your parties are going on. It's about the players getting themselves into trouble and then getting themselves back out of trouble. Mm-hmm. And that's the overall through line of every single story. You find yourself in trouble and then you have to find your way out of it. That's every narrative ever. That's the entire idea of narrative right there, is getting yourself into trouble and getting yourself back out of trouble, or maybe getting yourself into deeper trouble. That's what the rules are designed to simulate. Even the war game side of things, even with, you know, armies fighting each other, they're designed to create these historical moments that you see, events like the Battle of Hastings or, the Battle of Waterloo, where you have kind of these epic turnings of the tides. They create situations like Washington crossing the Delaware and catching the Hessians unaware on Christmas Eve. That's what the rules are designed to allow the players to do with each other. And so it's not on the DM to create the story that the players will then play through. It's on the DM to arbitrate the players making decisions so that by the end of it, you have a story.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. Using the rules as written leads to those story quality situations. You know, you could not have prepared something this good, because the players did this to themselves. The players prepared for an adventure. Yep. They went out here and now they have found themselves constrained in some particular, maybe completely random way. And now the players are going to figure out how to deal with that, because players are super resourceful. It's amazing. I love seeing it. I've always loved seeing it. Even before I went full on zero prep, I would just prepare by coming up with just some crazy situation. I don't know how they're going to resolve it, but they're going to, and it's going to be cool. You know, give them a little more than they can handle, and they're actually going to handle it. And it'll surprise you every time.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to enjoy it too. You get to enjoy it with the players. Something else that's lost with the players not being able to fully control it about how they prep to adventure and how they decide to adventure. What are we going to go do today? You know, maybe I don't want to go do this thing that he planned with, some goblin camp that, we're supposed to investigate or whatever. Well, we don't want to do that. You know, we want to do something else. Or we don't want to investigate it that way. We want to send some scout off there while we do something else. When players have that kind of freedom, they are going to balance the game for themselves.
Yep.
They're going to quickly understand how much risk they enjoy taking. And all you have to do is not stop them from doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to tell you what they want to do.
Yep.
And they're going to want to approach things a certain way. So if they want to try and get by just with the tightest number of rations and just one tent and nothing to spare, that's how they want to play the game.
Yep.
You know, and they've balanced it for themselves right there. And let them do that. You don't have to balance encounters. You don't have so much weight is taken off the DM, and it's so much better for the players whenever you just stick to the rules in ways that you can't imagine. And if you read the stuff in Appendix N as a DM, you start to break yourself out of these little mind traps that you have, where it's like, okay, but this wouldn't be fair, or that wouldn't be fair for the players, you know? But actually it is, and it would be awesome.
Yeah.
You know? And it explains more of the game to you as well. It's like, okay, so not only can that happen, but it's actually really cool if that happens.
Yeah.
And, now I've actually got ideas for, what to throw at them when that happens too. There's no excuse not to read Appendix N. If you want to be awesome D&D, just use the rules. It's not that hard. It's not unfair to the players. It's more fair to the players. And I was never anti using the rules of D&D. I always appreciated the fact that these rules exist, and seeing how much trouble people have for not using the rules of D&D is like you're doing this to yourselves, guys. Like,
yeah.
It's that simple.
And the other, like the other side of this coin, in, you know, talking about letting players be resourceful, a lot of people have mentioned this, like, you know, Harmony says danger is good, actually.
Yeah.
There are situations where your players are going to make bad decisions. And so this is the other side of the tent discourse, you know, when you have people saying, you know, I don't want my character to suffer the consequences of not having bought a tent. They're asking for the consequences of their agency to be taken away. You know, Rex Teal said earlier, why roleplay being dumb when you can actually feel dumb? That's the other side of player agency, is sometimes your plan doesn't work out quite right, or sometimes you just have a bad plan, or you make a bad decision, and then consequences will, you know, play out. The dice will fall as they do, and you might find yourself in situations that are disadvantageous, or you might find that you were a little too smart, or maybe not smart enough for your own good. And so the other side of this is players dealing with the consequences and accepting the fact that they're, you know, if their decisions matter, then that means they can make wrong decisions, and those decisions will also matter.
Right. If there's only one outcome for decisions, and that's regardless of what I do, things will be okay. Mm-hmm. Then that's not a thing. That's not an outcome at all. Like, that's just guaranteed. That's rails. You know. But you know, for the players who have exercised their freedom and agency, and they didn't prepare for something, and now they're out there and, you know, they're not equipped for it. And, or even whenever, like, they're in town and they decide to do something dumb, you know, I'm going to just shoot this guard. That's a good idea, right? And, you know, okay, well, actually that was really dumb. But you know what? People do that in the storybooks too.
Yep.
You know, why not? Why not let them do that? Why not let them, like, that's not unfair. It's not unfair. They're going to have adventure that comes after this. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll lose that character, but now they can, you know, play the character's sister who wants revenge for it. I don't know. But, you know, you've got a jailbreak lined up after this. Cool stuff can still happen, even after the players make stupid decisions.
Yeah.
But let them, and they're going to have a story to tell after that. And it's going to be an in-group thing now to, you know, to have a jab at them whenever they go back to that town.
Mm-hmm.
That's perfectly fine.
Yeah, you have to account for the possibility that someone's going to go Mr. Blonde and be unnecessarily brutal and create more problems for your party. It's just a matter of letting everyone at the table know, and You would hope that something like this would be obvious, but for a lot of players, and I think a lot of GMs who try to pivot their games into these, you know, styles of play, run into issues where their character, like their players are like, well, I didn't expect this to happen. I, you know, make it not happen, DM. You have to make your players understand, I am giving you the freedom, but with that freedom comes the consequences. So, you know, yes, yeah. If you do go super brutal and you do go Mr. Blonde on someone, it's gonna make some serious complications for this heist you're trying to pull.
Yeah. So you didn't ask me about my background in tabletop role playing, so I didn't get to bring this up. But my history, like pre D&D or pre role playing games, was mostly video games.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And that's like Final Fantasy, NetHack. And I was always on like the peripheral of being able to play D&D. So I didn't get to play D&D until I went to college. And then I played in a 2-year campaign, and that was pretty awesome. But before I played D&D, the one thing that I knew about it, and I was right about it, was that it wasn't a video game. It wasn't going to be a video game, right? So in video games, there's specific things that are coded that you're able to do. But you know, in Final Fantasy, you can't go climb trees to solve your problems, right? But you could do that in D&D. You're free to be able to do that. You can do anything you want. It's not pre-coded. Your path is not set. And that freedom, that player agency, is like the thing that distinguishes it from other kinds of games.
Yep.
And where it's even different from, you know, other board games or card games or you know, other tabletop games, because there's room left in the rules for you to decide like how you want to approach things. And you have this referee like existed in war games where you can do stuff that's not planned for in the rules. And there's a way for that to be handled. And you can do it anyway. You know, there's not a rule for it, but you can do it anyway. But you can try to do it at least. And video games could never do that. And so for me, player agency was like the key thing that distinguishes D&D. Why would you take that away?
Right.
Why would you take that away from D&D? That's the whole thing there. So when the player preparation side of D&D is taken away, I think D&D loses like its soul. So that's my spiel on that.
Yeah, and a couple people are riffing on this as well. This idea that you brought up. Like Dundermoose says, you can do anything you want in a video game as long as the programmer thought of it before you did.
Yeah.
And then Crafty expounds on this. Because a lot of DMs do come into it with, and this is kind of the downside of coming at RPGs with a video game mindset. I definitely had this when I started, because I also came from playing a lot of video games. When you set yourself up as a GM to not, you know, account for players having freedom of choice, then you're basically imposing video game restrictions on a non-video game medium by saying, well, you know, that's not how I intended for you to solve this. That doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Or it shouldn't matter. If it does matter, then you're not a very good DM and you need to either get better or stop. But like, if that's not part of your programming, well, look, all of this is in your mind. It's imagination. So change your programming.
Yeah.
You can do that on the fly. That's one of the ways that video games will never be able to replace tabletop games fully, is the game can't recode itself on a whim just because you turn a different way. Only a human brain can do something like that.
Yeah. But quick question, because that reminded me. So I haven't played Baldur's Gate 3. Can you climb trees in Baldur's Gate 3?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, that's something.
It's a weirdly clunky way of doing things because it's based on like 5th edition, but you can climb some trees sometimes, I think.
Okay.
It's weird.
All right.
It's still like, I don't know. Baldur's Gate 3 does not solve a lot. It doesn't solve that particular problem very well, in my opinion.
Okay. That's fine. I was just curious. You know, that always struck me whenever I first played Oblivion, I was like, okay, this is kind of like, was before I ever played D&D. Like, is D&D like this? Like, no, D&D would let you climb trees. Like,
like Crafty said, you can only climb the trees that were programmed to be climbed. So, yeah.
Yeah, it comes back. It always comes back to that. Yeah. And so, like, as a programmer, like, came from video games, I was like, I'm ready to, like, be free of that. Like, this is the advantage of D&D. Yeah. So, I haven't been following the chat, but.
And Mega Blizzard Man has a good point here that he brings up. And I want this to kind of be the last point that we talk about as we're, you know, getting close in our time here. A lot of players don't even care if there's danger or prep or consequences. They just want to say they played D&D. And this is like, this ties back into the whole conversation about Matt Mercer being the gold standard and Critical Role, and like this concept here ties everything together. When I talk about people playing at playing, this is what I'm talking about. They don't actually care to interact with the mechanics or know the rules or understand how the game works. All they want is they want to make a charisma roll to try to sleep with something that you're not normally supposed to sleep with because they heard about it on Twitter or Reddit or something like that. They want to kidnap a goblin and make him their pet slash slave. And they want to make a character and get someone to draw anime art of them. And that's the extent of what they want to do in playing D&D. So when I talk about people playing at playing, this concept right here, not caring if there's danger or prep or consequences, they just want to say that they were at the party, that they sat at the cool kids table. That's what I'm talking about when I say playing at playing.
Yeah, D&D has come a long way, hasn't it?
It has. Yeah.
Most now it's the cool thing. You just want to be on the periphery of that, and you're cool. Mm-hmm. You know, get all the cool art to show your friends. And
it used to be that you got really into playing D&D and denied that you ever played it. And now you barely play it, but claim that it's your favorite thing. It's your entire personality.
Yeah.
My, how the turntables.
Yeah. It's crazy. I wonder where it's going next, you know?
I shudder to think. I'm just, on one hand, I'm excited for the tourists to not be around anymore so that we can get down to serious business. On the other hand, I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of people who just kind of like nope out at some point. So I'm excited and nervous about what will happen when the crowd moves on from this.
You know, I guess I'm not too worried about it. I think certain groups are doing amazing stuff by exploring the old rules and like resurfacing these old intentions of play. I think that good times are ahead, even if, yeah, you know, even if WotC's not the one to bring us into that era. I think that, you know, really exciting stuff is ahead.
Mm-hmm. And Jeffro, yes, we have been dunking on nerds tonight. So yeah, I mean, that's all I really wanted to cover tonight. You know, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I'd love to have you back on again at some point. Before we go though, you know, as you mentioned, I didn't ask you about your background, and I haven't actually gotten the answer to this question out of you yet. So, you know the rules here. The answer can be as philosophical or as sophomoric as you want it to be. But Raker, if you could put anything on a t-shirt, what would it be?
You know what? When I was in college, I saw, I had just started playing D&D. I was really into it, third edition. And I saw a t-shirt online that was, if you can read this, you're provoking an attack of opportunity. And I thought that was hilarious. And I must have told that to my sister because she got me that t-shirt. So like so I still have that. So I, you know, that's my answer for that, is that, you know, I got it. And, you know, I don't play that anymore, but yeah.
I've kind of moved away from, now I say this wearing a graphic t-shirt right now. But I have moved away from wearing graphic t-shirts just like as part of my general wardrobe, except at the gym. Mm-hmm. But my favorite D&D related graphic tee that someone got me was the stats in order with the tomato analogy next to them. And unfortunately, it faded beyond like being able to read. But it was the like strength is whether or not you can crush a tomato. Dexterity is how far you can throw a tomato. I loved it. It was my favorite D&D shirt ever. So
nice.
And Dunder, that would definitely get people out of a room if you put Bozeman Bose PFP on a T. That would that's an interesting choice that Bozeman Bo made.
Hey, he's got a profile picture for sure.
Mm-hmm. He's a good egg though. I like that guy. Yeah. All right. Well, guys, that's going to do it for Rolling Bones this week. Just as a reminder, again, we are in the last few hours of this campaign here for Guts and Glory Volume 1. We've got 37 hours to go. Wonky and I have appreciated all the support that you guys have given us so far. But, you know, here in the last 36 hours of this campaign, if you can get us to that 6,000 mark, you know, that'd be great. I would love that. You know, if you can't give, don't worry about it, though. This project will be funding, and so at some point you'll be able to get it regardless of whether or not you back tonight or not. So I hope you guys will, you know, slot us some support there. We definitely appreciate it. Raker, thank you again for coming on. This has been a great conversation. You are welcome back anytime you want to come on. So,
oh, thanks for having me, man. It's been great.
No problem
and,
at all.
And I'm looking forward to your Kickstarter as well. I've seen your work before, and I really like how you designed the module.
Thanks, man.
That you put together before. So I'm excited to see where this goes.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, until next time, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard, and I will see you guys next time.